Them.
So, good morning. So let me start first session, and let me ask Eva, who will be the chairwoman for this session.
Welcome everyone on the last day of the Wigner Scientific Symposium. I'm Eva Kovács. I'm working at the experimental solid state physics department of the Wigner Research Center, and today I will host the solid state physics session of this conference. First, I would like to invite Katalin Komares to have her talk about the optical spectroscopy measurements on carbon nanostructures.
Thank you, Eva. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Okay. Hello, everybody. This is talk will be about near-field infrared microscopy of carbon nanostructures, and this is a relatively new method, which is, was implemented in the Institute about 10 years ago. It's in room 51 in building one. So everybody who is interested in the details or about possible collaboration is absolutely welcome to attend anytime. All right. So let's start with this. The idea of near-field spectroscopy is to solve an old problem of increasing resolution in optical microscopy. As you all know, resolution is the minimum critical distance between two objects that can be resolved by an optical microscope, and it has a formula, but basically, but we usually as use the rule of thumb is that it's half the wavelengths of the illuminating light, which is for visible light, it's about 200 to 400 nanometer, and this is still a little bit too high for objects on the nanoscale. So this is the diffraction limited classical resolution limit. And it can be solved in principle somehow by just decreasing the aperture to very small, to about 10 to 50 nanometers. The problem with this is that when we, this is done technically by metal coated optical fiber that's transparent. And if you go below the half wave number, then we get a drastic decrease in the transmission. And I mean drastic by 25 orders of magnitude. So this means that this is very, very difficult technically to implement. And so the best resolution with this solution is about a few micrometers, but we are still at nanometers. And the solution was fundamentally different from all this. And this is the scattering, scanning near field optical microscopy, which uses a metal tip and the near field between the metal tip and the sample. So this is okay. Just to illustrate, if you have a sample like this, an inhomogeneous sample which started micrometers and then goes down to nanometers in detail, what we see by visible optical microscopy is a spot like this. What we see with infrared light is basically a big nothing. And if you use now scattering type optical microscopy, then we see we can distinguish all the details. And now I'm going to try to explain or at least illustrate what it means. So why do we use near field? Near field is the electric field between a metal coated optical tip or scanning tip and the sample. This is basically the evanescent. We can call it the evanescent field because by several names depending on the area of research what we are used to. We have an incoming light. This is the incoming electric field of the light. This is polarized because it's the electric field will basically will come up between the sample and the tip. We never detect the near field directly. What we see is we have an incoming light and we have a scattered light, and we detect the scattered light by any kind of far field method, any kind of detector that we use in this respective frequency area. Okay, so this interaction will modify the field under the tip, and this will, of course, depend on the optical properties of the sample. And what we have to do is we want to collect the light here, and from the properties of the scattered light, we want to determine the optical properties of whatever is below here. Now, the challenge is this. We have about a few, like 20, 40 nanometers tip here, but we are at about 10 micrometers wavelengths, and this means that we have a huge big spot around here. And this huge big spot gives us a huge big background detection. We can solve this, so I will show it in the next slides. Now, what basically is behind it, how we describe it mathematically, the scattered light amplitude will be directly proportional to the incoming light, and the scattering coefficient will be, of course, complex because we have absorption here. And what we want to determine is the amplitude and the phase of the scattering coefficient. Okay, so how does this look like? This is very simple in principle, but this has been implemented first in the early 2000s, and two tricks have been used for it. One is, of course, the AFM and the tapping mode. By using the AFM in tapping mode, you have you move it with a certain frequency, and then in your detection, you can have a locking solution which is tuned to this frequency, which is about 30 kilohertz, and you go about 30 nanometers up and down. So this will take care of a large part of the background scattering, but not all. And the next one, the next trick was to install this all the AFM tip and the light and detector into an asymmetric microzone interferometer. Now I will not talk. Describe you what it is. You can look at it in any kind of optics textbook. The main thing is that partly it will take care of the residual background scattering, but also an asymmetric interferometer gives you the amplitude and the phase of the detected light. So you have basically you will have a full information on your scattering coefficient today. All right. We have two quantum cascade lasers, which are more or less tunable in rather narrow frequency ranges, but nevertheless, it's good for some problems we can solve. Of course, if we had more money, we could buy a broadband QCL, and then we could cover the whole frequency range. But fortunately, we work together with the synchrotron source in Paris, Solar, who have now a SNOM setup, and of course the synchrotron light gives you basically unlimited possibilities in terms of frequency scale. All right, so what you have here, you have an instrument scattering, you have background scattering, and you have a reference beam, and in the end, the scattered light is going out, that's detected in the far field, and you get, to calculate the scattering coefficient, and then the question is what you can apply this for. So you can see spectra, or you can see optical signals of the samples with about 20 to 40 nanometer resolution, spatial resolution. So first, what you will think is that you can use this for molecular spectroscopy. You have molecules, and you go on the molecule, and you measure the signal, and then you can identify it. Unfortunately, the oscillator strength of these molecular modes is usually too low to make a high enough signal to cause high enough signal to detect in the detector. On the other hand, since we are Institute for Solid State Physics, so we know about solid state physics objects, and most of them have collective modes which have much higher scattering intensities as free electrons, phonons. Now, the other application of SNOM that has been developed over the past years was quasi-particle mapping. That's basically the game that you have quasi-particle excitations. This can give you enough intensity to determine its spatial distribution. And then when you have your quasi-particle, you can study your interaction of those quasi-particles with other samples. And that means that what we call it polarity imaging and interferometry. I will give some examples on all of them. Okay, so in my group, we have been working on carbon nanotubes for about the last 20 years. So we figured that this will be the best small objects that we can put under this small AFN tip. And what we know is that carbon nanotubes properties are defined by structure, and most importantly, they can be metallic or semiconducting. You can buy separated fractions of metallic and semiconducting nanotubes. So you have, and these two have different optical properties. Now, over the years, we have done a lot of studies on these, and we know that we can determine the optical properties of the semiconducting and the metallic nanotubes. This is the optical conductivity versus the frequency. And if we now zoom in to our range of interest, this is one of our lasers, basically here is one of our lasers, lines the dashed line. So around the frequency of the laser line, the dielectric function of the semiconducting is red, and the metallic tubes is different. You can calculate it, basically you do it by doing the Kramers-Kronig transformation on the transmission in quite frequency range. And if you calculate, okay, and now we want to know what exactly we are calculating, because we know now the dielectric function, and we want to determine the scattering coefficient. This again, I will not go in any details. That's written in the first part was a PhD thesis of someone in Munich in 2009. So you see, the method is very is pretty young. So you have the tip, you have the sample, you have point charges which are connected to each other, and the electric field induces polarization in the tip that in the end induces polarization in the sample, and it goes back and forth, and you sum it up as long as you think that it's really important. In the end, you determine the so-called effective polarization that will be proportional to the scattering coefficient. And in this, you use the polarizability of a in this case, a cylinder-like object, so this will be a prolate, and this includes the dielectric function that I have just shown before. So, and then you still have to simulate the tapping mode, so this distance is not constant, this goes, this changes with time. You calculate everything, and then you have, you can get your scattering coefficient in analytical form. Of course, the problem is that this is, you cannot invert that. But what you know is that if you have different dielectric function here, then you will have different signals in your detector. And if you do this calculation for carbon nanotubes from this one, then you see that the amplitude and the phase will be different for the semiconducting and the metallic nanotubes. This is actually not no absolute value. This is the contrast from the silicon substrate. And this is what you can calculate, and then you can compare it with your results, which is actually, okay. The results you want to now to measure on individual nanotubes. And this was again a challenge, but thanks to our collaborators in Japan, Professor Maruyama from Tokyo, we could measure these carbon nanotube field effect transistors, where you have a silicon dioxide substrate, and you have individual nanotubes across here. So you can place your tip on the nanotube and measure the near field signal there. These are horizontally aligned. I will show you in a minute a better picture. Okay. So what we want to do is to distinguish between metallic and semiconducting nanotubes, because they make it by a chemical vapor deposition, and they don't know whether they get a metallic or a semiconducting one. So they were looking for a non-destructive method to determine it for them. And what we can see here, so this is the sample from above, this is somewhere. This is the topography, so it's just an AFM picture. And this is the phase contrast that I showed before, but we have calculated. So if you choose two of these tubes, these are about one, they are probably individual tubes or small bundles of about 1 to 2 nanometers in diameter, and they are far enough, they are about 1 micrometer apart. you choose this one, the blue and the red one here, you see that the size of the two nanotubes is approximately the same. So if you had the same optical properties, then you would say you would get the same signal in the phase contrast. But in this one, you get a much, much higher contrast than in this one. This is almost zero. What, okay, go back here. Okay, the zero is here, okay? This is the semiconductor and this is the metal. Let me write this, okay? So so you can tell which is the semiconductor nanotube and which is the metal nanotube. And there's again, one more, what I want to draw your attention to is that this, I said that the nominal optical resolution, the spatial resolution is 20 to 40 nanometers because that's the size of the tip. But in fact, we are now having a much, doesn't mean that we can detect objects, we cannot detect objects smaller than that. So now what we are doing, because there's nothing around it, we can detect objects which are about 1 to 2 nanometers in size. So it's a pretty neat item. Okay, now then we can still use the limited tunability of our laser and do a frequency dependence on both of them. And what we see is that this is the phase which is more or less connected to the optical conductivity, let's say. And this goes shows a drupal-like part in the metallic nanotube and almost constant, consistent with the semiconducting properties of the semiconducting nanotube. So this was something what we really were happy of. But then this, I must tell you that this is a very, very competitive field. And we were very happy about this, that we could tell the metal from the semiconductor nanotubes. But then one of the leading groups in the field published a paper where they saw plasmonic interference in metallic carbon nanotubes. And what is this? This is that there are 1D plasmons which exist in single bond nanotubes. They come from the 1D nature and the electron-electron interaction, and they are called Lutterly liquid plasmons. Please don't anybody ask me what this is. There are a million people in the audience who know more about this than I do. Point is that what you have in the end, you have a propagating electric field. The propagating electric field reflects at the end of the nanotube, and in the end you get an interference pattern in an electric field that has a rather long wavelength. A high confinement ratio is a calculation on hexagonal boron nitride. It's basically confined vertically to the outside of the nanotube in a very narrow range. So this is, and what you can do if you have this electric field distribution, you can map that with your tip, and then you see the electric field peaks along the nanotube. So I mean, why don't we see this? We were really pretty unhappy about this. So we are the plasmons. Our first idea was that our signal to noise ratio is not enough, and the sample quality is not good enough. So we did, we asked our collaborators in Japan who did even better samples on a different substrate. And we also had a major upgrade on the system, 2019. I will come back to that at the end. But we also were thinking about what at exactly what wavelengths we were emitting in comparison with Wang's group. And then we realized that in the literature there is no contrast spectrum in the full mid-infrared range. So one of my students went to the manufacturer's site where they have, of course, much better lasers and other frequency ranges and measured the phase as a function of frequency between 900 and 2000 wave numbers, which is what this is. Okay, let me go more. This is one of our lasers what we have. And this is the other laser where it seems around which the function spree looks pretty boring. It looks like a metallic one. But here, we saw something very interesting, and this is a dip. And the dip is at the same frequency where the silicon dioxide photons are. Now that's surprising in a very very ways, because first of all, if it's silicon dioxide, then it's the phase, it should be a peak, not a dip. The other thing is that we have this was a silicon surface. This was not silicon oxide. This was a native oxide. It contained a native oxide of 2 nanometer bits. So we have a small, very small amount of silicon dioxide, and we have a dip that all leads to some kind of coupling, and probably a strong coupling between the nanotubes and the silicon oxide. So how can we study this further? We need a new, another substrate, and the other substrate was obviously what we could use was hexagonal boron nitride, because for strong coupling, I don't want to again to go into the details. We have a paper on this, and it's very nicely detailed there. If you do the measurement of silica, you do a map, and you see definitely you can see the plasma interference fringes. So this is now very nice. We could basically see the same, but the best book in the world. So, but we were not the first, of course. But for the one of the prerequisites of the coupling is that the dielectric function of the substrate is negative. So this is basically around the phonon resonances. So silicon dioxide has one at 1100, where we have a laser, and hexagonal boron nitride has one at basically 1400. Then we also have a laser. So we checked that on hexagonal boron nitride, and we also saw the interference fringes here. So that means that basically what we think we could prove that the effect what we saw is the comes from the interaction of the substrate and the nanotube. Okay, how did we do this? I will say that because we got this again from with the collaboration with Professor Maruyama, who the following, we deposited hexagonal boron nitride flakes on the silicon native silicon oxide substrate at some places, and then we sent it to Japan, and they deposited carbon nanotubes, which were partly on the boron nitride, partly on the silicon dioxide, and partly on both. And then we fought with the customs, but I don't tell you that part of the story. So we had the samples, and then we did a wide range measurement, because now we really needed a wide frequency range light somewhere, and that light came from the synchrotron in Paris. So what we can see here, okay, what's the story? Story is that you see you excite the plasmas here. This is the silicon dioxide surface. This is the boron nitride surface. And at this place, you know where the kink is in the nanotube. There we have a reflection from back, and there you get an interference pattern, but on between the silicon dioxide and the nanotube. And here on this part, we have the other one between the hexagonal boron nitride and the nanotube. Now, if you tune your laser, then what you can take, these maps at several illumination frequencies. Then you see that there, if you are at the you arrive at the resonance frequency of the silicon dioxide, then your fringe contrast basically disappears. You don't see anything. If you do further and you go to the boron nitride resonance frequency, then your silicon dioxide fringes come back, but the boron nitride, the fringes on the boron nitride disappear. So basically, you have shown the what I showed before, that those dips in the on the boron nitride and the silicon dioxide, they seeing that this proves that we have a strong coupling, and So we have strong field component and we have a strong coupling. And this means that we have an enhanced sensitivity to the surface. And this is actually, this works also in the near field. This works only very close to the nanotube itself. So what we can do is, if you go one step further, we can now detect what's below the nanotube here at a very close distance. But also, if you now fill the nanotube with something that's inside, it will be also sensitive to that, whatever it is, okay? And this is now molecular detection, because you can fill molecules inside, and then you can use this. So what we decided to use were, as I said, we worked a lot on nanotubes before. So you can have boron nitride nanotubes. You can basically roll up boron nitride as well into nanotubes. And you can fill fullerenes, our previous favorite material, into it. Actually, you can also anneal it, and then you can make a double boron nitride, and then you can dream about having a nanoscale coaxial cable and go to the grant agencies and ask for funding. But the main thing now is that you have a boron nitride nanotube, we have a plasmon field around here and here. So you want to detect the C60 inside by this plasmon field. All right. Okay, so what did we do? We prepared some boron nitride nanotubes filled with C60. We took our collaborators in Nottingham took the TEM pictures. They were beautiful. You could see them, and then we started to do some SNOM maps on it. Okay, let me try this. This is an AFM picture of a boron nitride nanotube. They are filled and unfilled. We did not use the same nanotubes filled and unfilled. We cannot do that. We chose two similar boron nitride nanotubes, which were about the same size, and compared them. So first, okay, let me start here. When you go to the photon frequency of boron nitride, then in both the filled and the neuron filled nanotubes, you see a map which covers the full range. It means that this is a nanotube and it consists of boron nitride. Okay, if you go to a frequency which is outside all the resonance frequencies, then you see nothing. Okay, so basically you don't have an optical signal. But if you now go to the one of the resonance frequencies of C60, which we know very well at 1429 wave numbers, then in the unfilled you still don't see anything. So you see things for nitride, but there's no C60. And in the filled ones, you see a rather inhomogeneous picture. You see something where you have a high signal, and you see something where you have almost no signal. Okay, yes. All right. So where you have no signal, that's the red curve. The red curve shows you boron nitride. This is now a spectrum. In the tunability region of the laser line, and the blue one shows you both boron nitride and C60 very very nicely. So you can basically you could detect whatever is inside here with your naked spectroscopy. But there's something which is even more interesting, and this is the black curve was a C60 film, which was about as thick as, or even thicker than the whole boron nitride nanotube here. So we had a lot of C60, and we see so absolutely nothing. So that means that indeed, what we need is the quasi-particle coupling to detect the molecules inside. Okay, so we got it. And so we calculated the detection threshold from the volume, but under the tip, and we see that we could see as few as 160 molecules in a 1 nanometer. Yeah, okay, this is the 3 to 5 nanometer wide nanotube. And I think that this is also a result which we are proud of. But we can see, go even one step further, and now we can really do chemistry. Which means that we can follow chemical reactions within the nanotube. So what has been known that you can shine light on C60 and then you get a photochemical reaction whereby you get oligomers, they will connect here, you have dimers or trimers or even longer materials. So we left the sample under the tip, we were shining a laser on it, 0.5 nanometers, and measured the phase once more, the functional frequency, and compared it with known spectra of C60 oligomers. So what you could see, this is very high, it's a very low signal to noise measurement, but we are pretty confident that we see what we see. This is the blue is the monomer C60 signal that goes down after illumination. And here we see, okay, this is the polymer. This is actually a mixture of monomers and polymers taken on the microscopic sample after illumination. You cannot separate this, and Eva Kovács is an expert on this, but the materials do not live very long, so you cannot take the spectra on them, only on the one which is that it contains everything. But we can see the dimer here, which is coming up, and what we cannot see actually, this is now this trimer, but where there should be a trimer peak, and this we cannot see because we are outside of the coupling range. So I think that I really wanted first to do kind of, I'm a chemist by training, so I was thinking about molecular detection and molecular reactions and using these nanoreactors, and now I think that we can go on in this direction. Okay, the other one, should I stop here? Or because they said that I have more time. 5 minutes is perfect. That's so this is about the infrared scattering near field optical microscopy, and the complementary method is Tippenheim's Raman spectroscopy, which we don't have yet. It's available at the synchrotron, so we may go into it, but we did some work with Lukas Nowotny's group at ATF Zurich. And the Tippenheim's Raman spectroscopy, I won't even tell even less about that than the SNOM. This just is there's also an AFM tip. You have a sample here, you illuminate it from here, otherwise the whole setup is the same, but except that you now don't detect the scattered light, but you detect the Raman spectrum, which is set up, which is set up for Raman spectroscopy. All right, now what we can see in this were graphene nanoribbons in carbon nanotubes. So we can do, I mean, you can do a lot of things in carbon nanotubes. You can do several chemical reactions. You can not only produce C60 polymers, but you also can produce graphene nanoribbons, which is right now really very, very exciting. In the graphene nanoribbons, you have several vibrational modes, which you can detect by Raman spectroscopy, and also in the nanotubes, of course. Nanotubes have the so-called radial breezing mode, which is just, you know, this, the tube just breezing in and out. It's a symmetric mode. We have also another one, don't talk about this. You also have, but in the nanoribbons, you have a sort of what you call a radial breezing like mode, where the vectors are here. You also have, because the nanoribbons must have some endings, where they are not constructed only of carbon, because you have hydrogens at the end. So these hydrogens also contribute to some vibrations. And you also have a G-band. This G-band is the in-plane vibrations in the nanoribbon, and you have similar ones in the tube, and the frequencies of these are approximately the same. These are not, these can be distinguished. This is different from this and this. Okay, so when you take nanoribbon inside the nanotube. You put something in and you do a chemical reaction, and you want to know whether you have really have a nanoribbon inside the nanotube or some kind of amorphous carbon or what have you. So you take a bundle and you do the topography. So this is what it looks like in the AFM, and then you go to the frequency of the radio breezing mode. So this is typical of the nanotube. And then you go to the frequency of the radio breezing light mode. This is typical of the nanoribbon. And this is now the G mode there you have both. And you see that basically the shape is the same. So probably you really have your nanoribbons inside here, and you really have the carbon nanotubes and not something else there. The difference is just the spectra just showed the difference between the tip up and tip down. That means that between the far field and the near field spectra, and you see that the near field really enhances the detection. Okay. Now I only just have to thank my collaborators, who are whom many of you know. One you might not remember, he is Ferenc Borondics, who was one of my first students, and he is now the beamline scientist at the infrared beamline at SOLAI. So that's why we have the connections to the frequency dependent measurement on the SNOM. Inside, we were collaborating with a lot of people, because this is material science here. You cannot do anything without having a lot of collaborators and we were. So at the Institute of Technical Physics, ETH Zurich, the NEOSPEC, the manufacturer, has helped a lot. We got beautiful samples from Shigeo Moramoto's group in Tokyo. We did the boron nitride samples were coming from Nottingham, and they also did some of the high resolution transmission electron microscopy experiments. And with Hiroshi Ozawa, we worked together with metal filled nanotubes, of which I didn't have time to talk. So, okay, and now I have to come to the funding. We had operating costs from a few of OTCA projects. And then our original investment came in 2012, which was funded by the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. And this time, the exact time when SFKI merged with RFKI to become Wigner, we got a major upgrade that was funded by the ERKHA in 2019, when there was a change in the MTR-ERKHA thing. And now this time we have going for ERKHA 200. And so I'm waiting for something. I don't know what, but I hope that there will come another funding, and I have a million ideas where to put it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kati, for this nice presentation. And now the talk is open for discussion.
I was amazed by the linearity that you showed at the very beginning, between the field coming in and the reflected wave, okay, with the phase shift, of course, but then there's also the sigma parameter coming in. I was wondering, would you learn something if you would increase the intensity and see some nonlinear effects?
Sure, we did. We are not there yet, because we are just about to understand the linear effect. Actually, my student, Daniel Dutz, is now having a much better model for the effect than the simple point charge, and this is on based on my scattering and okay, all this he has now another model. Of course, many people work on models, but actually,
other questions.
So what is the tip material that you use for?
Sorry?
The tip material.
Oh, the tip material is a simple AFM tip coated with platinum or any kind as well.
Okay, thanks.
Is there any other question? If not, let's thanks the talk again. Okay. Here's the present of the